All right, welcome back to the 9th London Intro. For this Thursday, you're very welcome to the programme if you've just tuned in. If you've just tuned in, where in God's name were you? And I mean, actually tell me, if you just switched on at 10, what were you doing between 9 and 10? You know, it's not a rhetorical question. 086 60 25,000. Tell me, I want your feedback. Though we did have, you missed a very busy 10 o'clock, not 9 till 10 hour, not least because... we had lots on it, talking about road safety and what have you, but we've had dozens and dozens of texts. We really do appreciate them. Road safety caught your attention as well. But on the defective block motion yesterday in the Dáil, a caller says, I can't believe what Pat the Cope said. He knows the scheme is not working, but he's going with his party anyway. What I say to him, he may have done plenty of good work, but if he doesn't stand with the people, is this what he wants to be remembered for? Read traffic. Morning, Greg. Letterkenny, they're talking about. I'm sorry, but last thing we need is more cycle lanes. There's a wide footpath from the hospital to the mountaintop, and cyclists could manage on the road. It's more road space we need to help with traffic along the lines of much of what we heard yesterday. A caller says, I was in Ards on Sunday walking back along the water towards the Friary. I heard what sounded like help, help coming from the water. I stood and looked out at the water but couldn't see anyone. Then I heard it again and realised it was sound being made by two large birds in the water. I was very relieved. This may be what happened at Straggle Beach in Buncrana on Monday evening. Hopefully this will make the person who contacted the emergency services feel better, as in my case, it was a realistic human sound. Thank you, Helen. Well, listen, Helen, the one thing I will say about that call in relation to Straggle Beach, the emergency services said it was a false alarm with good intent. So people should never doubt themselves. I mean, obviously, like you did, Helen, you double checked and then you realised it was birds, which quite interestingly were making it sound like help. But the emergency services would prefer to respond to a false alarm with good intent than not getting the call at all, at all. So I hope the person, if they're listening, who called in relation to Straggle Beach doesn't feel bad. They shouldn't. They did the right thing. But it's just interesting that you thought the bird sounded like it was a person shouting help. Anything else in that? Let us know. 086 60 25,000. Hi, Greg. If speed camera vans are meant to be located at accident black spots, etc., to apparently save lives, can you find out just how many lives have been lost on Glenties Main Street, as there was a van placed there on Tuesday afternoon, or as we suspect and probably in reality know, that this is just another cash cow for the RSA and insurance companies? Any info on this would be appreciated, and thanks. The logic is that there might have been a serious collision there, so it could have been a pedestrian knockdown. I can't recall, and I hope I'm not being insensitive, I can't recall such an incident. I'm not saying it didn't happen, but they can locate them there if there was a serious collision, serious injury or death. So that would be the justification there. There are a few places. There's one that parks in Donegal Town opposite the church, St. Patrick's Church there. It doesn't seem to make much logic. They get a lot of fines out of it. But maybe that there have been collisions there. I do know there have been collisions there. But in relation to Glenties, if anyone's got any insight, let me know. The traffic jam in Letterkenny caused by directing traffic at roadworks, stopping the flow. It's still two-way, no difference. He's stopping them. So I'm not sure what that means there. I want to go to another couple of things as well. I don't want to sort of bombard you with road safety, but it's an awful lot of what we're getting. So I'm going to bombard you after we talk about the cost of living. Chatting about ESB bills and everyone struggling to pay them, with the boil water notice over a month now and a regular occurrence in Glenties and Dunloe, supply costing a lot more, electricity running to boil water, it's a disgrace this, and it's going on far too long. Interesting point that I never thought about in an area with a boil notice. I got an update from Ishgaran about that last week, and they said they were continuing to monitor it and liaise with the HSC, but that boil notice is in place, so it's either, you know, it's either buying bottled water, which is an expensive in and of itself, or continuing to boil water for use in everyday life. A big inconvenience, and it's still ongoing. So leave that with me, and I'll try and find out. This doesn't take away from your point, of course, but I'm trying to find out if there's any sort of indication as to when that might be lifted. This listener was driving out the Derry Road this morning at 7:30 a.m. on a bus. I met a cyclist on the two-lane road, yet a big cycle lane empty. So even we build the lanes, they're not being used. And that is a trend. Right, now, Hi, Greg. If Roland was getting a €500 fine every time he was out on the road for not being lit up at night, he would soon start wearing them. Another. Hi, Greg. Back in the mid-1960s, we lived in Dromore and had to walk to the bus stop. There was no such thing as high-vis, so my mother got white plastic bags from the shopping, and cut the bottoms off them and put them over our heads with the handles on our shoulders. Frank, I'm not sure how useful that is, but that's an amazing memory. And mums and dads can be quite mad. I think that's something like my parents would do. You know, if you've any other stories of strange things your mum and dad did, and Frank, I don't mean this any disrespect, like, it's just not something you would see now, right? So maybe at the time it made sense. Obviously it made you brighter and maybe acted as a bit of a windbreaker. But it is kind of a peculiar solution to a problem. I think we can agree on that. So have your mums and dads, have you any recollection from your childhood of other peculiar solutions to problems that they employed? You know, maybe a dad that walked out of the shed with some crazy contraption for you, or a mother who got around a particular problem doing a certain thing. Any memories like that, share them with me, please. 086 60 25000. It was mad in our house when I was growing up. I'm bound to be able to think of some myself when I have a moment. But, like, as I say, Frank, I'm not being in any way disrespectful. It's just the idea of it that in the mid-60s, cutting the bottom off a plastic bag, pulling it over the kids' heads, and the straps were shoulder straps, right? And their bodies then were out through the bottom of the bag. I think that's... it's interesting. I think it's a lovely memory to high-vis all the way. Yes, another. Free high-vis jackets at every Garda station. Okay. Now, let's get to some of your announcements and requests. A sum of money was found on Tuesday outside Home Bargains on the Strand Road in Derry. We have a number of the person that found it. So if you happen to be listening from Derry, or you travelled into Derry and lost a sum of money, it was found outside Home Bargains on the Strand Road in Derry. We've got a telephone number here now to collect that. Margaret Anderson is in Stranorlar. Hiya, Margaret. Hopefully you're listening. It's your 85th birthday today. Have a great day from your son, Tony, and daughter-in-law, Wendy, and also from all your grandchildren and Margaret Anderson in Stranorlar. A very happy birthday too from me, Greg, and the team here and everyone listening. And we always welcome your voice notes. Here's a request sent in to us.
Please could you wish Belinda and Seamus Sheridan happy 15th wedding anniversary from Mum Philomena and Sister Louise.
I see. So Caroline's high-speed settings actually affect the playback in here. Let me try that again, slowed down.
Please could you wish
one second.
Belinda and
Sheridan happy... Right, let's start that again.
Please could you wish Belinda and Seamus Sheridan happy 15th wedding anniversary from Mum Philomena and Sister Louise.
Well, you've done it yourself. Thank you so much for that. And if you want to send in your request via voice message, it does feel a little bit more personal and special, doesn't it? 086 60 25000. We're more than happy to accommodate them for you. So any wee messages like that, use our platform, because it's your platform. It is the 9 till noon show here on Highland Radio. So the Tip O'Neill Irish Diaspora Awards for 2025 are this Friday, the 17th of October, at the wonderful setting of the Inishowen Gateway Hotel in Buncrana, with three very distinguished recipients, Danny Hutton and Vincent Keaveney, and Eileen and Sean Donaghy. And we had Eileen and Sean on the show earlier in the week, and Danny Hutton was a guest on John Breslin's show as well. So I'm very pleased to say good morning to recipient Alderman Vincent Keaveney, CBE. Good morning, Vincent. How are you?
Good morning, Greg. Hello. Good to be on the show. Great to be talking to you.
Yeah, indeed. And you're still in the office, so you haven't made your way to Donegal yet, have you?
I'm on an early morning flight tomorrow. I'm on the Logan Air flight out from Heathrow tomorrow morning into Derry City, and spending the morning in Derry and then over to Buncrana in the afternoon.
Lovely stuff. Right. Originally from Dublin, but very strong Donegal connections. Remind us, Vincent.
Well, my father grew up in Moville. He was the youngest of a family of 12 in Moville. He ended up in Dublin. I was born and grew up in Dublin. But yeah, strong Donegal roots. Donegal's always been a very important part of our family story.
Obviously, you know, you're well known as a very distinguished lawyer and a civic leader. How did you find yourself sort of in that line of work? Did you sort of study to you know, match your ideology, your attitude, or did that come after you became a lawyer?
I was a lawyer for I came over to my story very very like many of Irish students. Qualified, came over to London, really just looking for a year or two of London experience before I went back to practice at the bar. I was originally called to the Irish bar in Dublin. That was in 89. And here I am 36 years later, still here. I, like a lot of Irish people, I fell in love with London and London life. And that was really what sort of kept me here over the years. But the city then, an involvement in the city of London, sort of happened almost by accident. Just, I'm a firm believer, if you keep saying yes when people ask you to do interesting things, you never quite know where you end up, but very often it's in a good place. Mm. The late Peter Sutherland used to tell a story, the great Irish business leader and indeed politician, he used to tell a story that his father said, you know, a bit of advice from his father that, you know, if you're on the pitch and the ball lands at your feet, kick it. I think it's generally a good idea to kick it in the right direction, but I think there's something about that, just taking opportunities when they come.
Pardon my ignorance, but you've been, you know, you're of great renown in terms of a more equitable and global competitive financial industry. But if I think of sort of the financial industry and big money and money changing hands and what have you, sort of words like diversity, sustainability, inclusion would not necessarily be the key words I'd associate with that. So correct me and explain to me what you have been achieving and trying to achieve in this area, this sector.
One of the big focuses I've had, Greg, is around social mobility in the financial services sector. And that's, you know, there's two elements to this. One is the moral case that, you know, you shouldn't be held back by the jobs your father did, or, you know, the postcode, the accent you have. That's one element of it. But it's also a really strong business case to this as well. More diverse businesses, you know, make better decisions, stronger boards, better risk outcomes, better business outcomes. So I'm a strong believer in greater socioeconomic diversity, greater social mobility, particularly in the financial services industry, which I came over from what was Ireland in the 70s and 80s was a very different country, you know, a lot poorer. There's a very flat society. I really didn't come across the whole class thing until I moved to England. And then in the city, you saw the sort of the impact that class can have on people's lives and outcomes years after, you know, they came to London. And I was very keen to do something about that and was able in my year as Lord Mayor to put a focus on that. And I continue to chair an organization called Progress Together, which focuses on this challenge, creating greater socioeconomic diversity in the financial services industry.
So when that works, what's happening?
Well, what you'd like to see is that people coming in from whatever background are getting to the top, into senior levels in their organizations, at the same pace as people who come in from more privileged, more higher socioeconomic backgrounds. And the stats we have, we do a lot of research into this, is even with the focus we've had over the last few years, that's not happening. That people coming into the industry from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, irrespective of performance, they don't progress to the senior levels as quickly as others. That's the challenge we've got.
Is that a greater challenge now? You know, and I'm not saying this would be in this sort of DEI space, don't get me wrong, but there does seem to be something of a shift in terms of equality and fairness. Maybe that just applies to certain demographics, or is it across the board where people feel more emboldened maybe to, you know, not be quite as fair as they might be?
I don't think it's... I think a lot of companies are probably feeling the political pressures, particularly the headwinds coming across in the States. If you're an operation that's got a big presence in the US, the political environment over there is difficult at the moment. Navigating that is going to be challenging. But that's why I pushed very hard on the business case for this. And one of the things I've been doing is getting senior leaders, the people who lead big financial services organizations that feel strongly that this is the right business thing to do and the right moral thing to do, to get them to start talking about it. People like Debbie Crosby, who runs Nationwide Building Society, people like that. Actually, once business leaders talking about this makes a big difference too, and it pushes back against that sort of narrative that you're describing, Greg.
What is the Sheriff of the City of London? That's a post you had from 2018 to 2019. Are you on horseback? Do you have a shield?
I did spend a day on horseback. Riding around the city, but that was only to raise a bit of money for a charity.
Right. That wasn't too far wrong.
Wasn't part, Wasn't part of the job spec.
Right. Okay. But, so what is the job? It's a very nice title, obviously.
It is a very ancient title. All the counties and cities in the UK have sheriffs or high sheriffs. They're all appointed. Ultimately, they're appointed by the Crown. The City of London, going all the way back to the 1200s, has elected its two sheriffs for the year. And that's been that's one of the sort of ways that the city has sort of carved out a little bit of independence. And the sheriff today is there really supporting the Lord Mayor. You're there, the two sheriffs are really the Lord Mayor's wingmen, there to support the Lord Mayor, to help the Lord Mayor get the job done. You're based in the Old Bailey for the year as well, in the Central Criminal Court in the Old Bailey. You sort of live there Monday to Friday, which is that's the weirdest thing, but it's also sort of a wonderful thing as well to be living in this extraordinary historic court building where all these amazing, extraordinary trials have happened over the years. But to be actually living there, you know, my wife and myself and the dog, I mean, it was going for a wander around the Old Bailey at sort of 11:30 at night when there was nobody else apart from a few security guards there. It's one of those sort of slightly surreal experiences.
And does it afford you any privileges, you know, historic privileges that aren't exercised any longer or anything along those lines? Any little quirky?
Well, there's not the office of sheriff. It's a very ancient office, but today it's largely symbolic.
Yeah.
But the office of Lord Mayor, which I went on to hold in 2022, and I was the first Irish citizen to hold that office. I was the 693rd Lord Mayor, but the first Irish citizen to serve as Lord Mayor. I'm finding myself as Lord Mayor at a time. I was there on the steps of the St. Paul's Cathedral, greeting the members of the royal family as they arrived for the Platinum Jubilee service. Only weeks later, then, of course, we had the death of Queen Elizabeth II and the accession of the King, doing the proclamation of the King on the steps of the Royal Exchange in the heart of the city, things like that. As it was a real moment of national history for the UK, and to be doing it as an Irishman who turned up in London expecting to get a couple of years of city experience before he went back to Dublin, that was an extraordinary time in my life.
Yeah, indeed. And significant for the massive Irish population over there. Have you been able to, because I'm receiving a few messages that are talking of your importance within the community and working with the Irish community and people in business over there. Does your position afford you that? And what kind of work have you been doing?
You're right. And one of the things that was really, really positive about that was the number of either first generation, second generation Irish living in London who came up to me and said, listen, we never thought we'd see an Irishman in the Mansion House. That sense that there's no door you can't walk through any longer in London. It's a really powerful thing. And for a lot of the, particularly the children of the Irish generation who came over in the 50s and 60s, I think that's really, really powerful, positive messages to get out there. That is behind us now. We are absolutely playing a part in UK society and in London society. So that was a really positive element to it. And of course, it's a great convening power. You can bring together. As Lord Mayor, I took office in November 21. And if you might thinking back then, it was a tricky old time in British-Irish relations. It was fairly chilly, but I tried to focus in on those positive things, is the sporting, family, cultural, business links that you persist despite all the politics of the day.
So, obviously, Sheriff of the City of London, Lord Mayor, CBE, and now Tip O'Neill, Irish Diaspora Award winner. Where does the latter fit into these life achievements? This is a high recognition in your home country, Alderman. I'm not trying to put words into your mouth here, but when you got the call, how does it feel to get this recognition?
It's great. It really is wonderful. And that Donegal connection in particular with the family, with the links. I'll be seeing a few of my cousins tomorrow night in Buncrana. I'm great, great, looking forward to that. My parents, thankfully, both my parents are still with us. So I'm looking to them. They're coming up to Buncrana tomorrow morning, and I know it's a huge thing for them. And celebrating these moments, those connections, particularly when it goes back to the family roots, is really wonderful. And to be able to celebrate it with members of the family and with friends is just brilliant. It really is.
Well, congratulations for all you've achieved so far, this award, and what you will achieve into the future. We really appreciate your time this morning, Alderman. Thank you.
That's great. Thank you very
much,
Greg.
Look after yourself. Goodbye. That's Alderman Vincent Keaveney, CBE. He is a cousin of former TD Senator Cecilia Keaveney, by the way. So that's part of the family connection in the Moville stroke Inishowen area. And it's lovely for all of them. And congratulations once again. We had a brilliant reaction to Eileen and Sean Donaghy, by the way. You know, they might have plied their trade in Australia for the last 40 years odd, but they certainly haven't been forgotten with the connections that they had here at home and the connections that they made with people from home over in Australia. We had a huge reaction to that. And I know John had a great reaction to his Danny Hutton interview, and lovely to hear then from Vincent there. Okay, back with more shortly. Every great moment in history begins somewhere. I believe in superhumanity. The words of Aaron D'Souza, president of the Enhanced Game, when speaking at the second conference on human enhancement at Oxford University last December. The lucrative Enhanced Games are hugely controversial. And Shane Ryan, one of Ireland's most decorated swimmers this week, became just the 11th athlete to announce his intention to participate. And I wanted to get the views of Patsy McGonigal, former Ireland Athletics team manager. Patsy, thanks for joining us. I really do appreciate your time.
No problem, no problem, Greg.
Shane Ryan's on the record saying this is a financial decision, but this is going to eclipse all he managed to achieve clean in the sport, surely. What's your views on the Enhanced Games?
Well, I mean, obviously from Shane Ryan's point of view, it's going to seriously impact on his legacy as a great swimmer. Just for the public out there, I mean, Shane Ryan, three times Olympian, obviously, and in addition, you know, he was the one Irish guy that got a medal at world championship level, you know. So he was, that's his legacy right now. But now joining this new, what I would describe, a show business group in Las Vegas, it's definitely going to big time impact on his legacy. What do I think about it? Well, I mean, the word show business, the fact that it's based out of Las Vegas nearly tells you what it's all about, really. It's a financial scenario. It's a games that they intend to hold next May. It'll work over 4 days. It involves weightlifting, it involves athletics, and it involves swimming. So three major main sports, and then very difficult to understand. But there is a parallel argument, I suppose, that it's finance as well. Shane Ryan is at the end of his career. He would be very unlikely to make another Olympic Games, and making his case, he would find himself financially. So what do I do next? And he has this opportunity, and there is big money involved.
There is, but it's also really, you have to think about it, do you not, in terms of sort of sport and athletics. More broadly speaking, because now you're going to have these asterisk world records, and they're actually giving bonuses to anyone who can beat world records in certain disciplines and what have you. And I'm just wondering, you know, if you're now dropping your 12 or 13 or 14 year old off at training, you know, and asking them to slug it out for nothing more than personal pride and achievement, and their heroes are taking enhancing drugs. And competing, I think someone, if you loved athletics, you'd probably have to, or swimming, you'd probably have to look at it and go, like, morally, is my financial gain worth potentially what I'm doing to everybody else?
Well, personal to him, obviously, but I mean, from a sporting perspective, and from people who are involved in sport in the normal world, this doesn't wear. It absolutely does not wear. I mean, it's not only will, should they break a world record, they won't be recognised. These guys are going to be, they are allowed to take, in that sphere that they're in, they're not subject to any anti-doping, and that suggests that they're going to be taking drugs. The only thing that the, you know, American drug laws prohibit them from taking is cocaine and heroin. So basically, you know, they'll be on EPO, they can be on, growth hormones, they can be on all the stuff that will enhance performance. And the records will not be ratified regardless. So Ambi will be suspended. They will find it very difficult to get jobs in sport beyond these this games. So this is where I'm coming back to, really. It's show business, really, at an extreme end in terms of sport and taking advantage of sport to a point. Mm. And, you know, it says something as well that the people that are involved are very well-to-do tech kind of guys. The guy from PayPal, Donald Trump's son-in-law, you know, or son, you know, these are the kind of guys that are involved. So it's a bit of a... It is, again, I'm using the word show business, but it is an unfortunate development, and it's no example. It's absolutely 100%. These guys have wrecked their reputations, really. Shane Ryan will now be known as the guy who went off to this instead of what he really, really achieved, the big-time stuff that he did achieve. And the example that he gave to young kids, that's now blown out of the water, you know.
Yeah, and I'm not saying Shane Ryan ever did anything wrong, and he's been on the record saying that when he was competing, he was 100% clean, right? But in the back of my head, though, I can't help but I'm not doubting him for a second, and I certainly wouldn't make any libelous accusations. But there's somewhere in the back of my head is like, you know, it just again sticks a question mark in different places. The idea behind this too, though, I think, from these people, is to normalise this. And we're talking in advance of the first games. Is it possible that it gets to the scale, that you attract the names, that you attract the viewing figures, that you attract the razzmatazz, that it actually starts to eclipse the clean, real sports? You know, we've seen it a little bit in boxing. It's not about drugs, right? But some of the biggest contests now have been old guys coming out of retirement when they probably shouldn't be fighting, a 59-year-old Mike Tyson, for an example, or people who've got no boxing experience at all taking the main event spot that ordinarily would have gone to another boxer. You know, I'm just wondering, is it possible that if this does grow as these millionaires and billionaires want it to do so, that it will start to impact regular swimming, regular athletics, regular weightlifting?
Well, it's funny when this became public, you know, obviously because of Shane Ryan, really, Greg, that was exactly the thought that struck me. You know, it's basically an indication of the world that we're living in, and you know, and you've cited stuff from boxing. It's to me, it's an indication of the world. This something different, something sexy to a point. You know, it's just something out of this world. You know, trying to hit on people, and we it's unimaginable. Yet we just don't know where it's going to end. Mm. And you've summed it up very, very well, because we just don't know. Because these guys have money, these guys can promote it, these guys can push it, and they may be patient, you know, and they may stick with it, and it could. But look, you would hope above all, and hope that sport would remain as is, and yeah, human endeavour would be rewarded.
Just wondering if there's two events on at the weekend. One is people on enhanced drugs with you know, loud music and smoke machines and 500 grand up for grabs, and the other is, you know, seven guys or girls on, you know, hopping into the water, you know, just for the regular records and personal achievement. Where do the eyes of the public go? That's a problem.
That's a problem. That is a problem. You know, and I suppose, you know, we would hope that it would be a death. Mm. That's most definitely where you're at. You know, because science, bringing science into it at level and so on, is just, as I say, I used the word unimaginable, because the world that we live in, the world that we compete in, the world that everybody in all world recognized sports compete in, there is an idiom there, and you know, you would hope that would continue, and that this wouldn't just kind of mess things up.
Yeah, we'll see.
And so on.
I talked about the celebrity boxing, the Saudis with their golden ball in snooker, the Live League in golf. Yeah. You know, I mean, obviously, no one should necessarily have a monopoly on things, and we have to see how things advance, like darts, for an example, right? But this is just going in a different area and following it's following a model that has proven successful, and I feel this is going to be successful. And once it's normalised, you see, then the argument is that regular athletics or swimming or weightlifting is boring. Do I want to see someone lift 600 kilograms above their head, or do I want to see someone lift 350 kilograms above their head? I don't know anything about weightlifting. I'm pulling numbers out of my head. But anyway, yeah, we can only watch and see. Lovely to get your insight into it. Thank you so much indeed, Patsy McMonagall there. And just to talk of some of the money that's involved here, excuse me please, this is an event, by the way, that's penciled in for May of next year in a big resort in Las Vegas, a purpose-built arena. That's the type of money that's going around. So each event will have a prize pot of $500,000, $250,000 dollars awarded to the winner of each event. If a world record is broken, right, so this is where it sort of starts encroaching into regular sport. So if a record is broken, a world record is broken in the 100-meter sprint track, right, or the 50-meter freestyle swimming, the winner gets $1 million. So, you know, I mean, obviously with endorsements and sponsorship, right, some athletes are doing well, but you could be a second-level athlete who can run, you know, 10.3 clean in the 100 metres. Do you say, stuff this, I could win $1 million getting on the juice and running in you know, a 0.01 of a second below the world record and getting a mil? It's just going to be kind of potentially the death of a thousand cuts of clean sport. I hope not. I do hope not. But unfortunately, I've seen how big money coming into other sports, it can affect it, and it can ruin it. It can begin to ruin it. But then again, you see, they're appealing to a new YouTube generation, you know, TikTok generation. Not me. They're not looking to get my eyes on the sport, I don't think. Now, a century tomorrow, Friday, the 17th of October, 1925, the Boundary Commission, which was established as part of the 1921 Anglo-Irish Treaty, delivered its final report with regards to the decision regarding the changes of the border between the six counties and the Free State. Our historian in residence is Dr. Joe Kelly. He's with me now. Good morning to you. Good morning to you, Joe.
Maidin Weigert, Greg, as the Loch Deistiacta. Good morning to yourself and to all listening in Highland Radio.
So, was the Boundary Commission established just to divvy up north and south?
Technically, you're correct, but it was more than just that. Really, one has to go back to the Third Home Rule Bill in 1914. And Home Rule was on the cards for Ireland, and it would be given by 1914. The Third Home Rule Bill was 1912, and it would become law within 2 years. So Home Rule was coming to Ireland for the first time since 1801. Ireland would have its own government. It would still be part of the United Kingdom, but it would have its own government. And World War II broke out, and basically the British government said, well, look, we can just hold back there in Ireland. We need to have this war sorted out. And when the war is sorted out, we'll come back and discuss the Irish question. But in the meantime, because there was a 2-year delay between the law being passed in 1912 and it being supposedly implemented by 1914, the unionist community said, no way, we don't want Home Rule. So basically, they started a campaign where they imported arms, they set up the UVA, the Ulster Volunteer Force, they signed the Ulster Covenant, 471,000 men and women signed this covenant saying, we do not want Home Rule. In fact, 17,000 people in Donegal signed this covenant saying they didn't want Home Rule. And so they organised themselves. In the meantime, 1916 happened, and this southern, mostly Catholic areas, mostly nationalist areas saying, no, we don't even want Home Rule. We want a republic. We don't even want to be part of the British Empire. So when we get to the other side of World War II, 1918...
World War One. That's World War One, isn't it?
Sorry, World War One. My apologies. At the other side of World War One, in 1918, the whole political perspective had changed in Ireland. And so not only had that changed, but also in England, Asquith, who was the Prime Minister pre-World War, was replaced by Lloyd George, a Conservative. So the Liberals had been changed by the Conservatives, and Lloyd George and his Conservative Party were very much in the Unionist camp. and basically seen to it that the unionist voice in Ireland would be looked after first and foremost. And then the side effect of that would be, will we look after the nationalist after that? So basically we're coming into, you're talking about 100 years. The idea was that they would look at the border again and see how it was going to be divvied up.
Prior to this, there was no border at all. It was the one island of Ireland and always had been.
Always had been and always should be. Mm. And again, I always go back to Wolfe Tone, the greatest Irishman, according to Patrick Pearce, that ever lived. Talked about the United Irishmen, where it was both Protestant and Catholic. You know, that there was none of this division. We were united, even though we were different. And what really happened was Carson, who was actually an Irishman and was a unionist, ran a brilliant campaign, particularly in the six counties. His idea was, well, we're not going to get a situation where we're going to have no home rule. So there is going to be some home rule in Ireland. So what can we do as a unionist community? The best we can hope for is to have a part of Ireland not in the free state.
So why Ulster then? Why that province? Why not sort of part of Connacht, Munster, Leinster?
Yeah, well, the first thing is that Carson himself was a Dublin man. But when you look to the population and statistics, the north, particularly the six counties, had a heavier Protestant population. And so it was an easy one, so to speak, that at least we look after that. But what people maybe don't realise, Tyrone, Fermanagh were majority nationalist, majority Catholic, massive sways of South Armagh, of Down. Newry was 75% Catholic. So the idea was, Carson saying, look, we'll take six if we can get it. And the question then, why don't we take nine counties? Because Ulster's nine counties. Well, then that would mean that there would be, the Catholic majority would be 45% Catholic, maybe, and 55% Protestant in the nine counties of Ulster. If they kept to six counties, it would be 65% Protestant and therefore 35% Catholic.
And
so
that,
makes it more manageable.
And also, was that with one eye on the fact that we'll divvy this up to the point that if there ever came a situation where there was a poll, a border poll, or whatever it might be, that we would always have enough of a majority to maintain our six?
That, and even something more sinister than that. And we'll see when Northern Ireland, the six counties, was set up, it was a Protestant state for a Protestant people. And please, I don't want to be in any way acrimonious with Protestantism and Catholicism. That's not my issue. I'm just talking as a historian. And we'll see when the Protestant state was set up for the Protestant people, they set up the B specials, and the policing was primarily to look after the Protestant people. They got rid of PR, which meant the first past the post, which meant that the unionist always got elected, not the nationalist, even though massive swathes, as I said, Fermanagh, Tyrone, were majority nationalist. They started gerrymandering, where they carved up the nationalist areas and brought them into Protestant areas, and therefore made sure that the Protestant areas had the majority. This is the politics of the time. It was brutal what happened, absolutely brutal. And look, there's nothing nice about this part of our history, but the border was drawn to the benefit of Lloyd George's pandering to the unionist community. And it didn't work out for both sides. And I have to say this as a progressive Republican. The unionists in Donegal, for example, Protestant people in Donegal were abandoned and thrown into the south. And so what? We don't care about you, long as we've got what we have. And nationalists were left in the north and abandoned. And so we don't care about you either, because we've got what we want.
Do we have any evidence? And I will go back, by the way, just want to leap forward while this question's in my head. Was there any evidence that, of a period of time where there was a movement of, you know, Protestants from, you know, either the rest of the Ulster counties or the rest of Ireland for that matter, or sort of nationalists going, right, this is what's coming down the track. You know, we're culturally quite similar to people in Donegal. I'm going to move over there. So did once it was agreed, and I will go back to that question, once it was agreed, did we see a movement on any scale that's recorded of people of different religions or unionism or republicanism moving between the Republic and the six counties?
Well, yeah, people physically did move. And for example, in Fermanagh, many unionists were moved in, many nationalists moved out. So the demographics changed there, even though initially the nationalists were in the majority. So there were movements of people, absolutely. Like the RIC was disbanded in 1922, the Royal Irish Constabulary. And some of those who served in the, so to speak, 26 counties moved into the north and became members of the RUC, the Royal Ulster Constabulary. So there were movements. And one has to understand, and I say this as a person living in Donegal, we as a county have suffered terribly, not just as nationalists, but also the unionist Protestant community have suffered terribly. And it's something in history that has been ignored. So, for example, you're a unionist living in this county in 1920, and you had gone out and fought in World War One for king, for country, for the Union Jack. And that was their culture, that was their heritage. And now all of a sudden a border was drawn and you were no longer a citizen of the Empire or of England. And you now had to become a citizen of the Irish Free State. And your birthright, in a way, was being denied to you, something that you'd grown up to have been used to all your life. And then all of a sudden, in 1920, that was taken from you.
Yeah, but I mean, look at the rest of the country. That I understand where you're coming from. They had to sacrifice an entire portion of the land. But it's like everything. There's always losers and winners. Dr. Joe Kelly, can you stay with me after 11?
I can.
Okay,
I
because
can.
Caroline always seems to magically think we can fit this entire conversation into 12 minutes, and Caroline's always wrong. No, she's always right. Okay, we'll be back with Joe Kelly. Joe, grab a coffee or something at 2 minutes past 11. A quick break, then the news, and lots more to ask Joe Kelly about the 100th anniversary of the Boundary Commission being established and, I suppose, acting out what we know today.